Hey everyone, we're back in, oh my gosh, chapter 17, but this is getting near the end, Rob. This is finally happening. We actually, we started the rapture. It is. I read a newspaper article, so it's obviously happening.
Yeah.
But I want to say we started this, it had to have been like last February or March, because that's when
just a few weeks ago. Moving. Yeah, we started like in February or March. So
of 2023. So like this is a year-long process. Yeah. Anyway. Chapter 17, they start talking about the great prostitute. This is a big deal. What is it? And is this more stuff that we're going to have to unlearn in order to relearn? We've been doing that a lot.
Yeah, I think so. This chapter is extremely critical to understanding the book of Revelation, as well as understanding what it means for us today. We get caught up in the beast and 666 and all that good stuff and the Armageddon and the Antichrist and all that good stuff. This chapter might be actually more critical than those chapters. I really believe that's the case. So let's start, Vinny, by reading the first six verses of chapter 17, and we'll get into it. By the way, happy Valentine's Day, sweetheart.
And to you, my love. You should have chocolates showing up on your doorstep. What I should have done, I should have been like, was that one place you bake it at your home, but they do like a heart-shaped pizza? That would have been right up your alley. Papa Murphy's.
Yeah, Papa Murphy's. I should have Papa Murphy's. I should have sent that to you. You're the co-host. You're the one that's giving
I
all
can't
your time.
Eat pizza anymore, remember?
Oh, my that's a good issues. Point.
See,
well, I'll do it for you though and just send it to myself.
There you go, beautiful. Oh,
okay.
The bromance is alive. Okay.
I'll even write a little Valentine note on the card.
Bet you will. Kisses too, if you could put some lipstick
no,
on.
No, I won't go that far.
Okay. No, okay.
I do have boundaries.
Yeah, apparently we found it. Chapter 17.
With that in mind, let's turn to the great prostitute in chapter 17.
With that in mind, yes. Anyway, I was going to make a comment. I don't want to slash a potential sponsor in the future. Okay. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness. And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had seven heads and 10 horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality. And on her forehead was written a name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus." Yeah.
Oh, your verse stop there?
Oh, actually, you know what? It does go on and it says, "When I saw her, I marveled greatly." But okay. I was making the cardinal rule of going off my translation. They put it into a new paragraph.
Oh, interesting.
They split the verse. Yeah.
It does relate to verse 7 and below, but when I saw her, I wondered greatly. Okay, yeah, interesting.
Yeah. So there's a lot out here, lots of imagery. I'm assuming this is not something literal, that she's not literally drunk. Correct. And it's the issue isn't necessarily sexual immorality. Imagery again, symbolic.
This imagery is really deep. In fact, as we go through the chapter a little bit further, it gets even more difficult. But maybe the best way to start here would be simply say this. Babylon for John was Rome. This is really clear. It'll be really obvious as we proceed. If you just skip down to chapter 17, verse 18 for just a second, it says, "The woman whom you saw is the great city, which reigns over the kings of the earth." And we discussed the great city, I think, on our last episode. The great city is clearly a title for Rome. And certainly Babylon, her name is, she has a name written on her, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes or harlots, however your translation might read. And Babylon, as we discussed already, Babylon's an epithet for Rome. Peter seems to use that in 1 Peter 5. I think maybe it's verse 13. "She who is in Babylon sends her greetings." That's got to be Rome. And it was used that way, not only by Christians. And in chapter 17, verse 9, it says that the woman sits on the seven heads, and the seven heads are seven mountains, and they're also seven kings. And we know that Rome was the city of seven hills. And so she's sitting on Rome. So she's Rome and sitting on Rome. So the question then becomes, what does it mean for today? And that's what we really want to unpack as we proceed. Let me give you a couple of quotes. One scholar says this: "While John saw Rome as an embodiment of Babylon, the ideological significance of Babylon extends far beyond the historical capital of the Roman Empire. Rather, Babylon exists wherever socio-political power coalesces into an entity that stands against the worship of Yahweh alone. Babylon expresses God's judgment on all human attempts to displace God from the center of reality in favor of human power and human power arrangements." Now, that sounds really good, but that also might be a little bit abstract. Okay. So another biblical scholar says it this way. Revelation 17 depicts the worldly and idolatrous, oppressive powers as a rich, self-indulgent prostitute enthroned on a beast, which ultimately turns on her to bring about her destruction. So maybe the way I would say it would be this. Babylon is materialism. She's commercialism. She's food, comfort, shelter, pleasure. She's all the things that can be good. I mean, that's one of the dangers of Babylon. Remember, Satan's key weapon is deception. These are good things, food, clothing, shelter, comfort, even pleasure can be good. But when they interfere with the worship of God, they become idolatrous or even blasphemous. And this raises a key point, I think, and that is when we hear what I just said, she's commercialism, food, shelter, pleasure, these things that are good, but they can become idolatrous. I think even for us, I mean, we probably look at that and go, yeah, that's just not really part of my life. And I think most Christians are thinking, okay, yeah, not really a big issue. And I think that's actually the point here. Satan's weapon is deception, and he's so good at it that we don't actually see it. And then the next problem becomes when someone comes along, namely a prophetic voice, and says, hey, guys, it's right there. Then we kick the prophet outside the city and maybe even stone them. And I think this becomes really dangerous. So if you're listening to this, and especially if you've been with us the whole time, you're probably following along pretty well, and we're not going to lose you. But if you're just jumping in going, okay, I'm interested in what these guys have to say about Revelation 17 and 18, hear us out. Listen to us with a discerning heart. Because I think Vinny and I are both processing this ourselves, as we said before, and grieving as we realize what this means in our own lives. And I think this is extremely significant.
And even just to bring that to an anecdotal thing, this might deter a potential sponsor as well. But I remember about, gosh, 17, 18 years ago, I started learning more about Walmart as an organization. And there's just a lot of issues coming out about how they treat employees and just what's happening financially with them. And so, like, my wife and I made a decision. It's like, hey, we're going to avoid shopping at Walmart.
Okay.
And I'm not making a judgment on people who do, because this is one of those things, like, this is going to be everywhere for us. We choose that. And I remember having a conversation actually with someone who you and I both know at a previous church. And I was sharing this with this person. And this guy said, because I was concerned about how just like the unfair labor practices, even in terms of the resources, like we could pay nothing for this TV because we're paying some, this company is paying some kid in China 90 cents a day to work all day to make it. And it's just so we could get it for cheap. And our friend, he said, actually, my bigger problem is not, it's not the bigger problem. It's not just that. But what we then have the problem with is that we now go to Walmart and we say, not just that we get a cheap TV, but guess what? I could buy four of them. And it's this overindulging and just stuff that we don't need. And it's that materialism aspect of things. And it's that second side of the coin when it comes to this stuff. It's just the materialism and just the stuff that we just absolutely engulf ourselves with, and how much is enough. And we're living in such a time of not just prosperity where we have so much money, but we could buy, even in the age of inflation, there's so much crap that we could buy for cheap on the backs of other people. It's just, how much do we need? And we always think we need more. And so this is the thing. It's like, yeah, it absolutely affects us in the church. It affects everyone because our whole culture has told us that we need to be able to have all this stuff.
Yeah, let me go even a step further and say, this is the hard part, and say, when we realize what Babylon is and the destruction that Babylon brings on human lives. And you and I remember know that in chapter 18, it's going to talk about slaves and human lives at the end of this list of cargoes that come in through Babylon. And at the bottom of the list, the least valuable item as far as Rome's concerned is slaves and human lives. And say, what if we decided not to just not buy four? What if we decided to not buy any at all?
Exactly.
Are we willing to say, because I know this was made as an act of injustice, our cell phones, the computers that we're on right now, the technology that we're using, are we willing to say, I'm not going to indulge in any of that? And I think most of us would say, there's no way I could do that. So I'll do the minimum. Okay. Have we compromised with the beast? Because
we're all compromising. Yep.
Exactly. Yeah. We're all compromising. So Vinny, you remember at a church that we worked at together that we used to have, I don't know what I call it, a bazaar at Christmas time from, what was that organization?
Fair Trade. I forget the
fair
name.
Trade. Fair Trade. Yeah. But there's a Fair Trade organization which basically made goods and sold them at the church that were made by people that were paid a living wage. So the idea, if you buy these goods, you know that the people who made them got paid a fair wage.
whether it's coffee or clothing or various things.
Exactly, right? And that's the whole idea. They didn't have televisions, so we couldn't do that. But they did have coffee, clothes, and bars of soap and things like that. And the idea was go buy your Christmas presents there. And people came back. They stopped it after like 2 years at the church because it wasn't working. And when I talked to people, they're like, I don't want to buy there because if I buy my grandson this, I can only buy him one present. I can't afford to buy him more presents. There you go. Willing to actually pay a fair wage to somebody because we're not willing to pay the fair price for that, because what that means is now I get less goods. The price of goods goes up, and that means I can buy less of them, and we're not willing to do that. That's the reality. I think you and I have to stop and look introspectively here as we send this on the airwaves to our 4.3 million listeners.
So, no, we get to
5 million by the end of the year, by the way.
It's 4.5. I don't know if you saw the stats.
Yeah, I'm hoping to get to 5 million by the end of the year. So, hey, guys, share this with others so we can reach our goal by the end of the year.
But seriously, I've challenged people with this, especially when it comes to issues of immigration and illegal immigrant employment and that sort of stuff. The same people who oftentimes are railing against illegal immigration and wanting to halt that and that sort of thing, I challenge them, like, hey, are you sure you actually want this? Because I guarantee you don't want to pay minimum wage to those field workers who are picking your lettuce and your tomatoes and your avocados. Because right now you could go to the store and you could buy an avocado for $1 or $2, an avocado. You don't want to be paying $8 for an avocado. And that's exactly what's happened if we actually paid people. So in our minds, we have this theory of what we want at the borders of immigration. But in your pocketbook, you actually don't want that.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
Yeah. So anyway, fun stuff. The Enlightenment. That's why we're not going to hit 5 million, Rob, is because we bring up these kind of fun Hallmark type moments.
We're going to be down to 3.2 million by the end of next week.
What a great Valentine's show we're having here. Valentine's Day. Word of advice, don't buy your loved one anything that was made outside of a fair practice.
Which basically means don't buy them anything at all.
Exactly. Yeah. Just give them a hug. Hey everyone, we want to thank you for joining us on today's podcast. And we want to remind you that everything we provide at Determined Truth is free of charge. And this even includes all of the teaching that Rob does on a weekly basis to pastors in India and around the world. We don't have any supporters that get special behind the scenes access. But we can only do this with the generous support that comes from those of you who can afford to give. So if you would prayerfully consider supporting us with anything from $5 a month or more, we will continue to work hard to challenge the church to be the church. To give, go to DeterminedTruth.com and click on the Give tab or follow the link in the show notes. Okay.
Yeah.
One of the things that we've talked about going all the way back to the intro to Revelation, and we always try to highlight it in significant parts, but your theory is that Revelation is marked out in four sections and there's different scenes that happen.
Yeah.
So what is happening in chapter 17? What scene are we in? And has anything happened here that's significant?
So this is really critical to understanding what happens from this point forward in the rest of the book now also. We talked about the two stories and how that was important to understand 4, 5 through 6, 7 and the middle chapters of the book. So now we have two scenes at the end of the book. And again, the scenes are clearly marked out because John's taken to a new location. Patmos in the first scene, he's taken to heaven in chapter 4, verse 1, taken to a wilderness here. And then the final scene in chapter 21, he's taken to a mountain. John's told to come, and John says he was in the spirit. So all those things are indicators of John saying, I'm changing and transitioning from one scene to the next scene. Now, the scenes overlap, and we'll discuss that as we proceed. So the seven angels who had the seven bowls from the second scene tells John, hey, come here and I'll show you the bride, the great harlot. So in this third scene, which is not necessarily a story, we call the first two stories, but that's okay. Chapter 17, 1 through 19, 10. I know you're listening and you might not be marking it down or whatever, but if you have a Bible, make that as a mark. 17, 1, beginning of third scene, 19, 10, end of the third scene. John is told that he's going to be shown the judgment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters. And he's taken into a wilderness and he sees a woman sitting on a scarlet beast. Then in the fourth scene, John's going to see another woman, and it's the bride or the New Jerusalem. Now, what's really critical is to recognize the parallels between these two scenes. So I know we're running a little bit low on time because we took a few extra minutes to discuss those things. That was totally fine. But let's read briefly, Vinny, if you want to read chapter 17, 1 through 3. And then I'll read 21, 9, and 10. And then I'm going to ask, hey, what kind of things did you notice in common? 17, 1 through 3, and then 21, 9, and 10.
Yeah. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came to me and said, come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness. And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had seven heads and ten horns.
Chapter 21, verse 9. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues came and spoke with me, saying, come here, and I'll show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain, and he showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. So what are some things that you noticed that stuck out to you? And read the whole script there as I have it in front of you, Vinny.
I'm definitely not going to mean the thing that I scratched out in the script.
Yeah, Vinny, you're the co-host and you do not have permission to scratch out the script.
Okay, so
here's what we'll do. I'll say it for you.
I can do it. I got it.
You got it?
Yeah. No, you Tom don't. Brady is the Antichrist. He is the third
beast. You got a blaspheme. No, I got it. I got you covered. Delete that for the episode.
Tom Brady is great. I love Boston.
Okay, that's great, Vinny. But what did that's you notice from this particular passage?
Suddenly, I've become a smoker for the last 30 years.
I got a little cough, something in my throat. I'll be all right.
You're coughing, and it just See, froze up better. To you. I feel better. So much better.
I was waiting for you to talk, so I could tell the audience how you got better.
Exactly. Yep. Okay. Oh man, you healed me.
What did you notice, Vinny? We're never going to finish, by the way.
But I'm very disturbed. Yeah, this is going to be a two-episode show. So you have the seven angels in both accounts.
Yeah.
You have
the seven angels.
One of the seven angels, yes. Yep. You have one of these seven angels had seven bowls, so I'm assuming it's the same angel. That's whatever. Exactly. Whatever it is not. Come, I will show you something. So in chapter 17, it's I'm going to show you the judgment of the great prostitute. The other one is I'm going to show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. So you have this contrast of the negative and the positive.
Okay.
Great. And then in chapter 21, he's carried away in the spirit, which you then also have after that judgment pronouncement is made in chapter 17. So you're carried away in the spirit, except for in 17, they're carried away into a wilderness.
Oh.
Whereas in 21, you were carried away to a high mountain and you're shown the holy city, Jerusalem, coming out of heaven from God. A lot of antithetical contrast here.
Okay. Yeah. In both passages, I'm not sure what your translation reads. It says he carried me away in the spirit. That's actually in both.
Yeah. Yeah. But,
first one's to a mountain.
The first one's into a wilderness. The second one is into a high mountain. Yeah.
Okay, very good. Okay, very good.
It's definitely paralleling each other, but it's antithetical parallelism.
Correct.
So it's opposite parallelism. Yeah.
The contrasting visions. It's kind of the right way of putting it. Yeah. Contrasting visions of two women. One's a great prostitute, one's a bride. Mm-hmm. That's right. And they're both cities. I alluded to this earlier, but in chapter 17, verse 18, it says the woman is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. In 21:10, it says the bride is the holy city or Jerusalem. They're contrasting cities. As you mentioned, one's a prostitute, one's a bride. The clothing actually is contrastive. We don't know that in this passage, but in chapter 19, it says the bride is clothed with bright and pure fine linen, whereas the prostitute's clothed in purple and scarlet. That's 19 verse 8. The prostitute's the home in a prison of every unclean spirit and a prison of every unclean bird. That's chapter 18 verse 2. And the bride in 21 verse 27, it says nothing unclean will ever enter into it. So there's all these contrasting elements to it, and we'll discuss some more of them as we proceed. Another thing that's actually really important, and we'll save this for later on, is that each of the two visions actually end the same way. In both cases, John falls down before the angel to worship it.
Yep.
19 verse 10, and then 22 verses 8 and 9. And he's told, don't do that. And the second time, you're like, why would he do that? He already was told not to do that. It's actually a literary feature. John's marking the end of each section with an identical episode. It's very significant. So we have two contrasting visions. The first story in chapter 1 verses chapters 1 through 3 was of John being on the island of Patmos, having a vision in the spirit, seeing Jesus and writing the seven messages. The second vision, he's taken into heaven in the spirit, and he sees God sitting on a throne, and there's a scroll and everything that happens from chapters 4 through 16. Now we have the third scene, and John's in the spirit again, taken to a wilderness where he sees a prostitute. And then the fourth major scene, he'll be in the spirit again in 21:9. and he's taken and sees the holy city, New Jerusalem. So these last two scenes contrast one another. Excellent.
So the question, though, is we should be reading these in light of each other? Is that the first?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, very much so. And it's kind of the idea of any that to whom do you give your allegiance? Do you give your allegiance to the lamb or do you give your allegiance to the beast? Now your allegiance is measured by faithfulness to God's kingdom, knowing that your reward is great in heaven, or faithfulness to the prostitute, knowing that your reward is great now because at least you get to eat. Remember, that's why Jesus said, why do you worry about food? Why do you worry about clothing? Worrying about food and clothing and obsessing with that and the comforts and pleasures of that, especially the injustices that come along with that, that's the harlot. That's Babylon the Great.
So interpreting the popular ways that these passages might be understood. I'm even trying to, especially with chapter 17, trying to remember the popular understanding of what this event might be, because when we read it in a popular standpoint, everything is in this event and then this happens and this happens. So regardless of what it means, the point isn't that the events of chapter 17 happen and then the events of chapter 21 happen.
Correct.
This isn't describing a linear thing. What it's saying is it's contrasting. I'll use Paul language from Colossians 1. Are you a member of the kingdom of darkness, or are you have you been transferred into the kingdom of his beloved son? It's just another way of maybe looking at that theme through scripture.
I wouldn't use the word member, though, because we are members of the kingdom of God. But even as members of the kingdom of God, the harlot is trying to seduce us and trying to lure us. And we all do this. So I almost realized the statement I just made before you commented there was one of those. The listeners are going, I don't know how to do this. And I think that's part of the point. We have to find a way to navigate through this with awareness of injustice and economic depravity and economic injustice and things like that. And we have to eat. So the reality is I'm probably eating a strawberry that was picked by someone that's not paid a fair wage. I'm probably wearing clothes that were made by someone that worked in a sweatshop. Okay, but how do we navigate through this? And then do we speak into the injustice and try to bring reforms, knowing that if we do, the price of goods is going to go up, as you brought up.
Yeah.
And so that's that quandary that we have to grapple with. But I think most of us are just simply unaware. And we think, well, I'm a member of the kingdom of light and I live faithfully and my heart is right. Everything is all good. And Jesus is like, no, there's economic depravity. And just a segue for just a second, when you get to the New Jerusalem, we will drink freely from the water of life. We'll eat freely from the tree of life. There's this emphasis on freely. Why? Because the people that were poor and oppressed had to eat somehow. And the only way they could eat was to compromise with the socio-religious political system of the Roman world. And they did so. And the question is, have we gone too far in our compromise so that we're actually worshiping the beast in doing so? Mm-hmm. And so I'm putting this in a first century context. And then we want to try to figure out, what does this mean in the 21st century context? And I think what it means is way worse than what we realize.
And even to expand on a comment you made a minute ago, you would basically challenge us, the modern believer, to say, I believe my heart is good and all that. Let's even make it more, call it what it is. We don't even worry about my heart is good or I'm living an ethical life. It's, I said the prayer, and so I know I'm going to heaven when I die.
Yeah,
that's like oftentimes we don't, especially in evangelical Protestantism, we don't worry about the ethic that comes along with things. It's a matter of, no, I went to camp or I walked the aisle, I said the prayer, I know that I am saved, therefore I don't have to worry about it. This is someone else's problem.
Yeah, that's even worse. That's even worse. Yeah,
yeah, it is worse. I'm not saying that part of it can't be true. God saves people. However, there's the ethic that goes along with it. And we get
the transformed life that has to be a part of the process also. Yeah. And I'm speaking more to the people that are regular church attenders that are saying, okay, I'm fine. I'm not sure that we're as fine as we think we are.
Yeah,
we are in a prosperous nation that is reaping the benefits of radical injustice, and we're unaware of it. And if we are aware of it, are we calling it out? And are we willing to call it out? Because if we do, it may cost me my job. It may cost me friends and community. It may cause me being ostracized, whatever social environment it might be. And it may also cost more from my wallet, because all of a sudden now the cost of goods is going to go up.
Yep. We hope you're enjoying the podcast. And we want to remind you that everything we do at Determined Truth, the podcast, Rob's blog, and our YouTube channel is available on the Determined Truth app. Directions on how to download the app is available in the show notes and on the DeterminedTruth.com website. Just click on the app tab. So I remember way back when, and I forgot when we had Dr. Alan Bandy on, and he was talking about divine law court. How does that play into the section that we're in now?
So this entire scene or story, whatever we want to call it, of the Harlot Babylon, chapter 17:1 through 19:10, is actually framed as a courtroom scene. In this courtroom, the judgment's going to be pronounced upon the great prostitute. The people of God are the plaintiffs. We're the one bringing the objection before the court. The defendant is the great prostitute. God has explicitly said the one who sits on the throne. So we know God obviously is the judge. And the charge against her is murder. So chapter 18, verse 24, it says, in her was found the blood of prophets, the blood of saints, and of all who have been slain on the earth. The case then before the judge is, how long, O Lord? When are you going to avenge our blood? The courtroom then climaxes with chapter 18, verse 20, that God has brought judgment for you, the plaintiff, God's people, the ones who have been murdered. Chapter 18, verse 4 says God has remembered our crimes. And it goes on where God's people rejoice and say, God has pronounced judgment for us. He's avenged our blood. So absolutely, it's a courtroom scene, no doubt about it.
So this brings me then to another idea, because we're talking about especially economics and society and how people are treated. I think it was in the Gospels we had Dr. Warren Carter on. It was at Luke, or I forget when we had him on. But he was laying out.
It was one of the Gospels. Yeah.
Yeah. And he laid out in his book, which is a really good book. That would probably be a book that's relevant to even this study of Revelation.
Sure. We'll try to bring him back on this episode to discuss this particular issue.
Yeah. Because he was talking about economics in the Roman Empire in the first century, and where the majority, 90% of the people are living at in terms of hand-to-mouth extreme poverty. And then you have that upper echelon, maybe 10%, maybe less than 10%. What role does that play in terms of understanding this passage as well?
That plays a significant factor in terms of understanding the passage, what it meant then, but it has a really interesting twist as to what it means now. So remember, just very briefly, there were 3% were the upper class and the elite who were prosperous. 7% were, they got by fine. They had enough food for each day. They ate okay, but they by no means were what we call middle class, but they managed well. Then you have the 90%, as you mentioned, that were basically hand to mouth, and they were 30, 30, 30. The 30% at the bottom really struggle for daily sufficient nutrition. What's interesting about that is that Rome ruled at the expense of the poor and the marginalized. As I already mentioned, the slaves and human lives in chapter 18 that we'll get to later. Now, I wrote some blogs on this as we're recording this. They're coming out right now, but as this goes live in early March of 2024, the blogs came out in February of 2024 talking about the beast and what that means. And I think a couple of them are titled, "What is the beast and have we been lied to?" As I was researching for those blogs, I found it interesting that the Roman peace, the Pax Romana, was actually celebrated in the literature. I was doing some research like, okay, what is Wikipedia? The Roman peace was a glorious era of the Roman Empire. Like, okay, now Wikipedia is not like the ultimate source, but I'm like, what? And other Google searches were bringing up all these great accomplishments of the Pax Romana. And I'm like, okay, the Pax Romana was horrible. Yeah, it brought peace, but it brought peace for the 3%.
Yeah.
And it allowed the 7% to have economic flourishing to whatever that might mean, but it was on the backs of the 90%, on the backs of crucifixions. In fact, the Roman historian Tacitus, who lived and wrote at the time of the Apostle John and a little bit after John, so late first century, beginning of second century, a Roman historian, he was a privileged member of the dominant class. He said this: robbery, savagery, and rape, they call government. They make a desert and call it peace. They ethnically cleanse people, they wipe out people, make them slaves, rape them, and steal from them, and they call that peace and government. So I'm thinking, oh my gosh, you're kidding me. Now, what does this mean for us today? This is what we got to grapple with, which you and I have been doing a little bit already, and that is, Vinny, we're part of the 3%.
Yeah.
We're not reading this as John's readers were. They were the 90% that were oppressed. Most of us are the 3%, maybe the 7%. But we're better than the 7%. We have at least more security than they do. I've got a week's worth of food in my fridge or more. So I think we need to grapple with this. How did John's readers hear this, but then go, oh, we're actually in the class of the oppressors? Oops, ouch. We just lost another 1.2 million listeners, didn't we? We're not going to make our 5 million goal by the end of the year if we keep this up.
It's interesting. We focus so much on this topic through the book of Revelation, which is so contrary to how we understand the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation is about the end of the world and this sort of thing. But so much, especially in this later part of the book, it's critiquing empire. It's offering an alternative kingdom, which is, we just miss that. Do we miss that because it's just not apparent, or would we miss it because we've been told to read it a different way?
Both. And by the way, this is not just Revelation. This is the entire New Testament, and it's really the prophets in the Old Testament also. The prophets are a little bit easier to understand because we know that they're writing to people who are under Babylonian oppression. We know that they're writing to people who are under Assyrian oppression or Egyptian oppression. We get that. They're an oppressed people, and they're crying out for liberation from freedom from their oppression. That's what the Exodus is all about. We get to Jesus, and we fail to go, hey, they're living under occupation. They're living under foreign oppression. They still are. We forget that because we've made Jesus about salvation, praying a prayer, dying on the cross for your sins so that we can be saved and go to heaven when we die, which is true, but it's not the whole story by any stretch of the imagination. We fail to recognize that Jesus comes in and says, I have good news for the poor, which he meant the ones who are being oppressed by Rome. That's the whole, if you read Mary's song in Luke chapter 1, that's exactly what Mary's talking about. You have heard the cries of the oppressed. She's like, you've heard the cries of the Jewish people and you're about to punish Rome. And Jesus is like, actually, it's not quite what you think, Mary, but we're on the same wavelength at least. I'm actually here for the oppressed throughout all the world, including the oppressed Rome, meaning if Zacchaeus, the tax collector who works for Rome, if he repents, he's in too. If Cornelius, the Roman centurion, if he repents, he's in too. And that's what caused the conflict. But it's exactly the point. And I think we need to stop and realize the gospel story is about restoring Eden. And the ideal of Eden, which was in the Deuteronomic law, was there shall be no poor among you. And I think we've discussed this here, but often when I teach, I'll use the example in Luke chapter 7, where Jesus raises this young man from the dead. He went over to the coffin, he touched the coffin. The story is not about Jesus raising the young man from the dead. It's about his mother. It says she was a widow, and this was the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. It's like, why are we stressing the condition of the mother? Because she is the definition of poor. She has no male to provide for her. This is her only son, and he's dead, and she's a widow. She has not only no one to provide for her, but she has no legal protection if someone wants to take advantage of her because she doesn't have the financial wherewithal to protect herself. So Jesus felt compassion for her. In the Gospel of Luke, compassion only occurs three times. And here's one of them. One of the other times, he felt compassion, and the Good Samaritan stops. Jesus felt compassion for her. And it even says when he raised the son from the dead, he gave him back to his mother. See, he's not just showing off how great he is that he can conquer death. That's true. That's what he's doing. But he's overcoming poverty by saying, you are no longer poor. And again, it's okay to give a sandwich to somebody on the side of the road or give some money or take them to lunch. That's good. But if we can change their conditions so that they're no longer poor, that's what the kingdom of God's about. That's what restoring Eden means. And one last anecdote here, Vinny, and that is the New Jerusalem is not just something future. If we think it's only future, we're misreading the scripture. Paul says you are a new creation. And Revelation 21 and 22 language of I will be their God and they will be my people. This new creation language, Paul quotes in 2 Corinthians 6 and says, you are the temple of God. As it is written, I will be your God and you'll be my people. That's quoting Ezekiel 37 and Leviticus 26. Thank you. Jeremiah 37 and Leviticus 26 is what he's quoting there. And the idea, this is the restoration of Eden. Jeremiah 26, by the way, has Eden language. I will walk among them, which is the language of God walking in the Garden of Eden. The point of that is that with the coming of Christ, the Eden is being restored. God's restoring his kingdom to the earth, and we are the means by which that's supposed to happen. And therefore, we do cry out against injustice. We do cry out against war. We're supposed to be a prophetic voice. But we're also in the midst of Babylon, and the heart of that is all around us. And guess what? I think she's winning. Yeah, and I'm speaking from my own life. I think she's winning. And there goes another 500,000 listeners. Man, we better end this episode.
We're going to be down to an even million by the end. Let's plow through the text a little bit. 17 verse 3, that's an important passage. It says, he carried me away in the spirit, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had 7 heads and 10 horns. What's the importance of John being taken into the wilderness to see this?
And I just actually alluded to that in the previous statement that I didn't realize it was the next topic that we wanted to discuss. So here's the deal. The wilderness is where the people of God are. I have not found this. I mentioned this to you before. I have not found this in any commentary. I don't think any other scholar that I've known has recognized this. But the word wilderness occurs three times in the book of Revelation. The first two are in 12:6 and 12:14. both describing the woman, the people of God, who was clothed with the sun. She was taken in the wilderness where she had a place prepared by God, so there she might be nourished for 1,260 days. The third occurrence and the only other occurrence is here. John's taken into the wilderness to see the great prostitute. And I think this is critical. The great prostitute is where the people of God are. We shouldn't think, oh, the heart of Babylon, it's Rome, it's Vegas, it's going to these places and don't indulge in prostitution and all these wicked things. The harlot is in the middle of the wilderness, and the wilderness is where God's people are. And I think that's why chapter 18, verse 4 says, come out of her, my people. Oh, because she's in our midst. There are four women in the book of Revelation. There's the false prophetess, Jezebel, in Revelation chapter 2 in the church in Thyatira. Then there's the woman clothed with the sun in Revelation 12. Then there's the great prostitute here in chapter 17 and 18. And then there's the bride, the wife of the Lamb. So four. Now, if you'll notice, they alternate. Jezebel, an evil false prophet. And then you have the woman, good. Then you have a great prostitute, bad. And then you have the woman, the bride, good. There's no question that the woman clothed with the sun is the people of God. And the bride are the same. They're both the same. There's no question about that. That leads me to believe that Jezebel and the great prostitute are at least overlapping ideas. And Jezebel's in the church. She's a false prophetess. She teaches and leads my bondservants astray so they commit acts of immorality. Oh, but these acts of immorality are economic and social and political injustices, oppressing the poor and the marginalized for the sake of the prosperity of the wealthy and the elite. And it goes back to the question that we're actually part of the wealthy and the elite, and we have to grapple with this.
Okay. This great prostitute, she's riding a beast. Is this one of the same beasts from chapter 13?
It's the same beast, because a beast has seven heads and 10 horns in chapter 13 and also here in chapter 17. The beast comes from the abyss in chapter 11. And John introduced us in chapter 13. So she's riding the political imperial side of the empire, and she represents the material, consumer, financial side of the empire.
Okay. Verse 4 says that the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality. In a sense, this makes me think of like the throne room scene in chapter 4, where God is described as all these wonderful objects that are beautiful. I'm not saying that's necessarily a parallel. It's just, this is another time where you have this bad, someone on the bad side of the equation, and she's also described with these very important, expensive types of things. And why would she have all this stuff?
As John would see her, she's gorgeous. She's beautiful. She's really well adorned. Gold and pearls and precious stones and fine linen and silk and scarlet and purple. She's really well adorned. But John's being told, she's a prostitute. Wake up. So she's attractive and seductive. And Balcom suggests that maybe she's the goddess Roma and all of her stunning glory. That's what an apocalypse does. It tells you what something really is. It appears this way. It appears that Caesar's on the throne, but God's on the throne. It appears that this woman is gorgeous and beautiful, but she's a prostitute and she's seductive. And guess what? She's got in her hand a gold cup full of detestable things. And what we find out actually in chapter 17, verse 6, is that in her cup, she's drunk with the blood of the saints, with the blood of the witness of Jesus. And we'll get into this next time here. And that is, so John falls down and he's amazed. He's marveling, depending on your translation. He's like, oh, wow. And he's attracted. He's being seduced, and the angel's going to say, oh, why are you amazed? We'll pick it up there next time. How's that?
Interesting. Okay.
That was a lot to process. I think we should stop here.
I was going to say, that's
a... going to get so much more difficult. Yeah, it's going to get so much more difficult. And then let's save the rest for next week. We'll go through chapter 17 the next week. We're going to finish this in a couple weeks.
Chapter 17?
Yeah, yeah. And maybe we'll have 5 million listeners by then.
We'll get back up there. Yeah, we'll do our fundraising, our spring fundraising. Awesome. So I feel like we've been sprinkling application points throughout the text, because you accurately understand it, you cannot come up against an application point. But is there anything to drive home?
No, I think we've done enough already. We've beaten the sheep enough and given them enough to go, what do I do? And I think you and I have to go, what do we do now? Yeah. I'm struggling personally, just having a meal. Going, I'm eating this good food and the kids in Gaza have no food at all. I'm here doing this and they have no home. It's a struggle. And it's just, and I know it's because of American taxpayers' money that's going to blow these people up. And what are we doing about it? So I'm struggling with that.
Even like I shared with you a couple weeks ago, I was diagnosed with a hiatal hernia, nasty thing. And it's completely altered how I have to eat for the rest of my life. It's not going to be a repair. Yeah, this is just what it is. And I've even thought it is very expensive to eat healthy because I have to eat extremely healthy and extremely limited now. And I'm like, I mean, the majority of people in America, especially the poor, we train them to eat crap. Why is it that we have fast food places everywhere in poorer communities? It's so much easier to eat chicken nuggets and cheeseburgers every day. And it's so much cheaper. Yeah. It's funny. It's still expensive to eat out. But man, it is expensive to eat the way I need to eat in order to not have acid reflux and all this. I'm spending so much more money on food now to make sure I'm buying good quality food and certain things. And even there, but I'm fortunate. This is something that's not really making a dent in our finances. I could just do that. And the layers of it, what about all the thousands of people who have hiatal hernias who are low income and they can't afford that? So the fun times. Okay. So next week we'll continue to get through chapter 17 and see more marveling and see what the angels asking. That was a good teaser, man, about John, about the marveling. So I'm excited to get into that one.
Oh, cool.
Starting in verse 7. So cool. All right, everyone. Okay. Hope you have a good week. We'll catch you guys next time.
I want to thank you for joining us on today's podcast, and we would love for you to share the work of Determined Truth with others. Please follow this podcast and give a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Your review will go a long way towards helping others find this podcast. Then share it with others so that we can get the word of the gospel of the kingdom to more people.